And we're back with Rob Cantley on the line. Can you hear me, Rob?
I can hear you, Paul.
That means I pushed the right button and touched the right dial and hopefully dialed the right number. Unless you're another Rob, but don't tell me if you are another Rob, because that'll be like this special surprise somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, there's a few of us around.
Well, but you are from Facebook. So Rob and I have never met, but I've heard about what he's been up to. That's why I wanted to get him on the program. Your full name is Robert Hamazaki Cantley. Is that right? Or is that just a Facebook name?
No, that's correct. It's on my birth certificate and all that stuff.
Okay. So it's for real. And you are, well, I was going to ask, who is you? You know, what's your history in Port Townsend, Jefferson County?
So I've been living here since about 2003. I've been raising my kids in this town. It's kind of the reason why we chose to come to Port Townsend as a idyllic place. We were in Seattle previously, my kids have twin boys, and they just graduated high school, class of 2020. So shout out to all the graduates who had a very interesting year.
Seriously.
I'm a community member here. I've been working in the trades, mostly carpentry, working on houses, building new homes, remodels, that kind of stuff. I also coach both the boys and girls soccer teams at the high school in Port Townsend, and also just been
away.
Yeah, just been recently getting really active with the recent movements since the killing of George Floyd, and as you can tell from my name, it's a Japanese middle name. That's my mother's maiden name, and so I'm a mixed race person of color. Japanese, also Armenian, and Anglo-French.
That's a wild combo.
Yeah, it is quite a wild combo.
there's all sorts of like oppression and like oppressing in like those combos, man. It's like, I mean that, but you know that's the genetic. Yeah, and that's cool. So Armenian, Japanese, European. Port Townsend, Jefferson Countyan, Rob Cantley, Rob Hamazaki Cantley. So, I guess I wanted to talk. It's cool that you've been here since 2003. That's 17 years out here. And did you move from Seattle? Is that what you said?
Yeah, we did move from Seattle. But I will say I'm not a native Northwesterner. My father was in the Marine Corps, and So I grew up my life moving all the time as a military brat. So I spent most of my early childhood in Japan, and then some of it, like middle school years in the States on the East Coast and Alabama. But I spent the majority of my teenage years through high school and a little bit after in Germany.
Wow.
Went to college in Michigan before moving to the Northwest.
Yeah, that's you've had a full and big life already, and you're only like what, 23, right?
Yeah, 23 for about the 22nd time or so. today is actually my birthday. So.
Oh, happy birthday, Rob! Oh man, hey. Oh, I have to come up with a birthday song for. I got to do something. You're my first birthday on Filter. Well, this is only like the 10th show, so yeah, you're the first birthday. Now I'm like, how do I sell? Well, you know the happy birthday song is now back in the public domain. So I, you know, not that I couldn't play it, but I guess, you know, you couldn't even sing it at restaurants. Right. So maybe I'll do that. Maybe we'll, but it's like the worst song. So it's like, I mean, I don't know. There's so many better, like every Mexican restaurant, happy birthday song is better than the original happy birthday that for some reason, Time Warner was so protective of for so long. Doesn't make any sense. But as you can tell on Filter, we can really talk about anything. Eventually bring us back to the topic, and that was, well, first, also congratulations to your son, and it's weird time to graduate, but also, you know, an iconic time in history and a time of really important change, and he'll never forget this, and it'll impact him hopefully in a positive way forever. So
just to correct you, them, and they're twins.
So oh, there's two. Oh, I missed. Okay, I missed that before. Oh, that's awesome. So you just double duty. Oh man.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I didn't have twins. Oh man, but I'm glad for the other people who are able to take on that level of stress and work. So nice job. I don't envy you, but I at the same time it must be really cool to see that work out.
Yeah. It is amazing.
So what's your history with, you know, social activism, social issues? You say you were really galvanized by the murder of George Floyd by Derek Chauvin, where he knelt on his head for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And I think a lot of us really were like, maybe we considered ourselves radicals, activists before then, but just, you know, the fomenting of anger and righteous indignation towards the police, towards the systems that have held people down. You probably had some of that brewing in you before that, but this was maybe like a tipping point for you to actually go out and hit the protests?
Yeah, so I'll give you some background in how I, you know, as a human, have felt drawn to, you know, standing up against any kind of oppression or injustice, things of that nature, and getting involved and active to, you know, do what I can as one person to work with other people. So when I lived in Germany, and this was in the early 90s, and I was there when the wall came down. And so there was a momentum in certain elements of German society of neo-Nazis protesting against, protesting is kind of...
Yeah, they don't get really to call it protesting, nothing. Right?
Yeah, just being stupid people with an influx of people coming from Eastern Europe, and also because there's a large Turkish population in Germany that started filtering in the 70s, and they're kind of the equivalent of Mexicans in the United States. There's a large population of them, and especially where I lived in southern Germany, in Bavaria. And so I was involved with the German version of Antifa, the Antifasciste Aktion, anti-racist groups. You know, I wasn't a, you know, combat boot wearing, you know, leather jacket clad, whatever. But there were, you know, punk skinheads that were anti-fascist that I would, you know, team up with. And, you know, it was direct anti-fascist action, which is like violent confrontations wherever we saw them, protecting groups of African immigrants and Turkish people from, you know, these roving mobs that would come through town from time to time. And so that, you know, there was some really hairy, chaotic moments, you know, getting in these massive.
And so these are roving mobs that were attacking basically Turkish immigrants in Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, they would show up, especially during festival season. So if you could picture Roadie Fest, and if there was a sizable immigrant population here, and then, you know, 20, 30, 40 group strong of skinheads just came in and were intimidating and harassing people. And wherever, you know, we got a call, you know, we would show up and deal with them, you know, and send them packing.
That's awesome.
That's kind
of
how.
And that's the definition of Antifa, right? Like that is Antifa exactly. As we know it in the U.S. It's not a hierarchical organization like some people in government or even people who don't know any better would like to believe. It is actually like it's a concept, right?
Yeah, yeah, it is. And there's a media narrative around Antifa that's just you know, completely false and like a boogeyman, and a lot of people don't actually understand the history of anti-fascism in Europe and how when it came to America as anti-racist action in the 80s as part of the punk movement. So it was, you know, people weren't going out and, you know, demonstrating and like breaking windows and stuff. It was just wherever those groups of skinheads showed up, we were there as human shields to basically kick them back to wherever they belonged, which is actually nowhere, but... So that's basically how I spent my teenage years before I moved back to the States to go to college.
So and you are actually original Antifa.
Yeah, as much as I can claim that kind of credit, Yeah.
I'll give it to you. Germany. I'll give it to you because, I mean, you know, like conceptually, I mean, I love going on Facebook and telling people that, you know, they're like, oh, there's Antifa thugs. And I'm like, hey, I'm Antifa. And they're like, I've just reported your profile to Facebook and the terrorists and the FBI's. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And that's fine. I mean, I'm anti-fascist, you know, and that sort of that concept, I think like it's so funny because people, and you're right, the media can't help but build this narrative. And I hate to say the media in general, because I really do think, I mean, I'm a journalist and I see so many different facets of the media, but like I do see the mainstream kind of steamrollers that sometimes start on these concepts that don't make any sense in reality, like Antifa being some kind of cohesive terrorist organization. And then you have folks saying, oh yeah, Antifa, they're terrorists. I'm like, you know, Antifa is like the United States Army in World War II. Like that, that is like the original anti-fascist action.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
yeah. So to move forward, when I was in college, I became active there with other students on campus because I studied history, sociology and stuff like that. So a lot of liberal professors and so I got involved with anti-war organizing their labor stuff, being active with women's rights groups on campus, campaigning against like fraternities with their high incidences of rapes and things of that nature. I spent a lot of my time organizing against, because this was in the mid to late 90s, you know, the Clinton administration was continuing the original George Bush's policy of strangling Iraq with sanctions, you know, after the first Gulf War, and, you know, periodic bombings and things of that nature. So I was heavily involved in campaigning and doing stuff to help, you know, try to lift those sanctions, you know, going and talking to Congress people. Actually went to D.C. a few times to lobby Congress people there. Actually met Dennis Kucinich, which was kind of cool.
Wow.
And so, I was involved in that kind of stuff and then traveling to other cities like Philly, D.C., Boston, New York, wherever there were large demonstrations that were going on. That was like my early 20s was, you know, just being kind of fired up by that that drive. And I came to Seattle and WTO. Was happening. Mm-hmm. So that was like my welcome to the Northwest.
Did you have the twins at this point?
No, this was before. They were born in 2002.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and WTO was 99, right?
Yeah, right at the end of 99. And then when I came to Seattle, I worked with a local environmental organization that was working to preserve roadless areas in the national forest. This was like the very last year of Clinton's presidency. And so we were trying to, you know, get this, this bill passed through Congress to preserve, like 80 million acres of roadless areas in, national forest, most of them west of the Rockies, which we were successful, and which, kind of immediately just undid all of our good work.
Of course.
So, after that, when I had my kids, I kind of felt like, well, I can't be out, you know, taking risks, you know, because I have been arrested a few times for civil disobedience and things of that nature. So I kind of felt like I, you know, just need to kind of hold back a little bit on being a little bit on my radical side and focus my attention on my children, and kind of reconciling that this is going to be my activism for the next two decades, is to raise two men, American men, and functionally they're white, their mother's white, so you know, raising two white boys in America, which is, you know, a highly privileged class of human beings. So I felt like my responsibility to raise them in a conscious manner so that when they grow up, they're not just going to be, you know, any old person, but, you know, they have a conscience about them and they know how to think and act, in a way that is, you know, consistent with my values and what I'd like to see for change in the world. And I like to think that I've done that and been successful in that because they did go with me to Seattle, before, Chaz Chop was established, you know, they got to see firsthand what police brutality was like.
So you were on the front lines out when Chaz, which later became CHOP, Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone to Capitol Hill Occupation, was it Occupation, Occupying Protest?
Occupying Protest, yeah. Occupying so protest. I was there before it was established when people were basically occupying the streets around the East Precinct in Capitol Hill. Just participating in some of the local marches led by the local Black Lives Matter and other Black-led groups, going from Capitol Hill, marching to, over to the Central District, meeting up with other rallies that were going on there, and then marching back across town, and just this beautiful coming together of people of all nationalities and races, gender type, economic background, that sort of thing. And the amount of support that I saw from just the general public as we were moving through town, and of course we're still in the middle of a quarantine, so people that don't feel safe being out on the street in these large crowds are hanging out of their windows with banners, and restaurants and cafes and bars would set up tables. It was like running a marathon, where they hand you the water as you're running. People passing out water, drinks, sacks of food, and I'm talking like good food, Indian food, Ethiopian food, Mexican food, burgers, like you name it. There was so much support for what was going on that, I had not seen this level of participation from just kind of this cross section of society where, in general, with previous actions against police brutality or other things like that, it was kind of a small subset of citizenry that would be involved, and other people, would just kind of sit back and watch.
Why do you think it was different this time? Why do you think it was different this time? And by the way, we're talking to Rob Cantley about the recent protests, both in Seattle and we'll talk about Portland after we do a song break in a little bit. But why do you think it was different?
I feel like over the years, as each high-profile incident of a police killing, Trayvon wasn't by a policeman, but just the killing of black men and women in general that become high profile, the ones that are filmed, Trayvon, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Philando Castile, like these things just keep coming up. And I think in this day and age with social media, that the message is taking a long time, I think, to seep into people's consciousness. But I think that the nature of how George Floyd was killed was so galvanizing that I think that no right thinking person could see that and not just be like, oh, okay, I think I get it now,
Yeah.
And then I think also maybe, how it's dovetailed with the quarantine and people being cooped up and just this energy pent up with this large release and, just seeing what's been happening across the country with, protests that are happening, not just in all the major cities, but in smaller cities and towns like Port Townsend, out in Twist and Swim and, small town America is showing up for these things. And I think it's hard to ignore that, if we as a society, and I think especially as a growing segment of society that are people of color, are children of immigrants or just are raised, I think, as a generation, to actually look at the world with a compassionate eye and to recognize where, injustice is being perpetuated daily. And I think this young generation, as much as, people like to rail against them for being, directionless, or they're just, they're attached to their phones all the time or blah, blah. Like, I think that's just an utter load of crap. What I see from these kids, and a lot of them are on the street, I'm talking high school kids, college kids, that age group, they are organizing and they are motivated and they're super savvy. I think the culture jamming, one of the examples that what we saw with the Tulsa rally for Trump.
Oh yeah.
Where
TikTok.
They jammed, the TikTok and the K-pop stars or K-pop fans, you know, and just basically booked all the tickets, you know, like that kind of thing. I'm just like, you know, these kids get it, you know, they get it, and they don't want to live in the world that you and I grew up in, or our parents or grandparents have grown up in. Like, I think, you know, they're getting an education earlier than we did, in many ways. So I kind of feel like, yeah. And just seeing like the police response, the federal response, to the, what's happening on the street. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's hard to ignore and hard to just, you know, keep telling yourself that, oh, things are okay. You know, it'll be taken care of, you know, like whatever, you know, it's not happening fast enough. And so I kind of feel like there's this energy, this groundswell. And, you know, I've been mentioning it over the week. You know, I kind of feel like 1967 was what they call the long hot summer, where there were hundreds of race riots across the country.
Mm.
And it was a, you know, tumultuous time in America with, you know, assassinations of black leaders and other people, politicians being assassinated, you know, Vietnam, like all of these things were just converging.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like we're at that point right now where, you know, we have climate action that we need to address. You know, we have a wannabe dictator in office that is just absolutely embarrassing us. Not that, you know, America as a, you know, a national, international power wasn't already embarrassing itself on the world stage, but this is,
yeah, it's really visible now. There's no denying it. There's no sugarcoating it anymore. It is just a joke. But I think before it was almost, I'm not saying Trump isn't dangerous, but, you know, maybe in some ways it was like more dangerous because we could put lipstick on the pig, and now we just have the full pig, you know, like it is straight. It is straight pig, and it is 100% 24 hours a day awfulness. Talking to Rob Cantley about Portland. Let's go to Portland. Take me with you via your mind ability to tell stories. How did you end up going down to Portland? You were at the Chop. You know, Chop did what it did, and, you know, I think it was useful. We almost don't need to dissect it now. Maybe we can do that on a future show. But what brought you to Portland? What brought you down there last week?
Everybody saw what was happening. And how out of control things got with the federal response to you know, protesters occupying the federal courthouse downtown. So I frequent Portland. I have friends that live down there. One of my good buddies from college that I was active with has recently moved there, so he was kind of my ear on the ground for a little bit, and I decided on a whim. I was like, you know what, I gotta go. I have the day off from work on Friday, so I'm gonna drive down there, spend the weekend, get my eyes and ears on the street, and see for myself what's happening. So I'd like to give just a shout out to my Port Townsend home support crew that supported me along the way financially. I guess that makes me a paid professional anarchist.
Yeah.
you know, covering hotel costs and gas and stuff like that. And you know, my friends in my BIPOC group that were my safety network that I was keeping in constant communication with in case anything happened to me. What I saw going down there Friday, you know, it's basically a 24/7 occupation. In the wee hours of the morning, it, you know, obviously thins out, but there are still people that are there, just kind of holding it down. And then during the day and into the afternoon, more people start showing up. And there's always rallies going on, speeches by local black leaders, from various groups, not just Black Lives Matter, but other groups. They would organize at one of the waterfront parks, make a march around town, end up at the courthouse, that kind of thing. And, you know, Riot Ribs was out there.
What's Riot Ribs? Oh, they're Riot serving Ribs. Food?
Yeah, they sprang up in the aftermath of the federal response to feed people that were there. Because people need to eat and have their energy up. So they were free ribs, burgers, hot dogs, that sort of thing, which is, you know, pretty beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, so everybody has this idea that, or I wouldn't say everybody, but I think that the general population that isn't there or isn't staying well informed with local independent media might have this conception that, you know, Portland is under siege, you know, and you could go anywhere in the city and not know that there was a veritable war zone going on downtown.
Mm.
You know, I would liken it to, I mean, I haven't like crunched the numbers, but the amount of square footage of where the action was compared to the entire city of Portland, it would be like saying the bathroom at Sirens was under siege, and then saying, "Oh my God, Port Townsend is in flames," you know, or something that, like that.
I have laid siege to that bathroom, by the way, as an aside. And it's not difficult to do. But yeah, no, I saw a map that was like, you know, because I don't know Portland that well, but I know it enough. I mean, I've biked around it. I've been in it enough to know that when you look at a map of where people were, you know, surrounding the courthouse, that is like, Portland was not on fire. You know, Seattle wasn't on fire either. Like Seattle, I mean, it's like these concentrated things, but the images that are coming out of that small square footage are just enough for once the visual is repeated enough times and people have no familiarity with how our cities work, you know, people in the middle of the country or, you know, who knows where, they have no clue, and it's in their interest to like believe that it's the whole city burning. I'm like, no, our cities are still better than yours. Like they absolutely are. They're just going through some real positive progressive change, but we're still way better than you guys. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But so yeah, when I went down there Friday, I saw the wall of moms and the dads with the leaf blowers, and you know, a group of vets had been organizing to show up as well in solidarity to, you know, help you know, protect the protesters and to, you know, protect the black bodies and other BIPOC bodies that were there. And the feds usually, you know, the party, as it were, wouldn't get started until after dark.
That's when the feds would come out, or were they there the whole time?
Well, they would stay inside during the day, and then they would come out at night. As the more serious wing of protesters that were there for the long haul would stay and, you know, would be up against the fence, the barricade they had around the building, you know, and people would start shaking it, you know, and just kind of, you know, doing their chants and listing off their demands and all of these things. And then so the feds would come out and
let me ask you real quick, Rob, how did you identify the feds? Like, how were you able to tell it was a federal agent and not a Portland police officer?
Portland police wear their blue uniforms, and it says police. The feds are in the camouflage. They look like military.
Mm.
That's kind of the basic.
So they weren't trying to disguise it at all. It was like, you know, just straight up. You could tell the federal agents from the Portland police.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're all in their riot gear and stuff, but the uniforms that they're wearing were very distinct and different. So the feds, I think they had at their peak like 113 there or something like that. So they would take it in turns, like in shifts to, you know, however many, a couple of dozen would be outside the doors in between the building and the barricade. And they would, you know, make announcements to the crowd. So like, please stop shaking the fence or we'll be forced to, you know, use force against you. And so it would just follow this pattern where they would, let off a bunch of tear gas into the crowd. They actually came up with their own leaf blowers that basically were spewing, tear gas out of them. And so this, you know, this, wave of tear gas would wash over the crowd and people that, you know, weren't properly protected would have to kind of retreat away, like a block away through the park. You know, get treated for a little bit and then they would come right back and just rinse and repeat. That would happen throughout the night. So I stayed down there until around like 1:30 or 2 o'clock on Friday. And there wasn't any further police or federal action against the protesters, but Saturday was a completely different story. When I got down there, same thing was going on, you know, a bunch of rallies, a bunch of marches coming in from different directions, people welcoming them, you know, drum lines, you know, wall of moms and vets and dads and, black-led marches, all kinds of things. And there were literally thousands upon thousands of people converging on like three city blocks in this park and in front of the federal building. That night, protesters were successful in tearing down the fence around midnight. And from there, there was a massive response from the feds, and Portland police came in force. So they started driving people directly away from the building by shooting, you know, tear gas canisters, rubber bullets, pepper balls, flashbang grenades to scatter the crowd. Portland police were flanking the side streets to corral people. To go up one or two streets in downtown, which were moving uphill away from the courthouse. And so that's where things got really, really chaotic.
Were they trying to kettle you?
They were kettling us up the street. And so what I saw transpire there, and so, you know, like the stories I've told you before about things I've seen, you know, fighting groups of skinheads in Germany, you know, other protests and stuff, you know, WTO, things like that. Like, I've been part of some kind of hairy things, but like, I've not experienced anything like this before. It is about as close as you can get to being in a war zone without like a deadly ammunition being fired. Not that you can't be killed by a rubber bullet or a tear gas canister if it hits you right.
Yeah.
You know, those things have happened. Yeah. But with the amount of explosions and chaos ensuing and tear gas and smoke in the air, you know, protesters were flinging 4th of July style fireworks, you know, at the feds, you know, so there are these colorful explosions going off in one direction and, you know, the fizz and you know, like a fiery sparkle that you see the tear gas canisters go flying. It was hectic. And there were some vets there that their PTSD kicked in. And a medic had told me about a vet that had gone catatonic, basically. And, you know, they had to drag him out of there. Because as soon as the explosion started, he, you know, his PTSD kicked in and he was frozen. It was absolute insanity. So as I'm getting pushed up, I think it was Salmon Street. And as you have hundreds and thousands of people going into a narrow channel, you know, these one way streets that then have obstacles like cars on the side of the road and trash cans and trees and fire hydrants and whatnot. It's like going through like a cattle chute, you know, and the police are just right on our heels, just shooting into the crowd, just willy nilly. They, you know, it had no care about, any, you know, safety. They're deliberately targeting press.
Could you tell if it was police and feds or just one or the other, or was it both? Just
it was
a big party.
It was mostly police, but it was mostly police that were doing the kettling. The feds were, as far as I can tell, were clearing up the park area and arresting any people that were left behind.
Were the tactics any different? Like, were they coordinating pretty well, or were the federal agents, like, I guess my question is, were they able to get away with more because they were feds or less because they were feds?
You know, I think they feel like they can just get away with anything. I feel like they're acting with impunity, you know, that, whatever happens, how is it ever going to come back on an individual officer, you know, who shot somebody or, you know, mercilessly beat somebody while they're on the ground, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, and I know police typically cover up their badges, you know, usually under the auspices that they're mourning a fallen comrade, but, you know, in reality, it's protecting their identities. And it's sort of that, the workaround, the public facing workaround that makes sense when you like, until you really think about it, or until you're at a protest where police are harassing and beating protesters. But the feds have any identifying information on them other than, do they have anything at all, like any way, even a badge covered up?
They have on their left shoulder a patch with a numerical alphabetic code. Three is usually two letters and a number. And so that they wanted to, the Homeland Security chief said that that is to protect the identity. So if they're not wearing their name, but they internally know who that officer is based on that. On that patch, but I mean, who knows if it actually is?
Right.
I mean, who's
right.
to say? You know, yeah. it's just all smoke screens or whatever.
It's like a barcode for Oscar Mayer wieners at Safeway.
So yeah. but yeah. So anyway, as I'm getting corralled up the street, and you know, there's flashbang grenades going off at my feet, and tear gas canisters, and people next to me getting hit. I mean, you know, like, I'll say this, that like, I came away from that unscathed, and I don't know for the life of me how, because it was literally people on both sides of me, in front of me, getting hit by rubber bullets, pepper balls, being shot with tear gas canisters. One of the guys that I was with on Friday night got shot in the back of his neck with a tear gas canister, and he's got these gnarly burns. Another dude that's a friend of his that he got shot in the face, was wearing protective glasses, thankfully, but still, you know, had to have 12 stitches under his eye. And you know, I was having to drag this young woman with me because she was completely blinded, with tear gas, couldn't see. So I'm dragging her through the street while I'm looking behind me, and, you know, 20 feet, 15 feet, 10 feet, this line of Portland PD with their, you know, 3 foot long billy club are just sweeping up, you know, people that are getting left behind. And at one point I was sure that I was getting arrested, because I looked in front of me, and there's, you know, at least 10 or 12 Portland police that had gotten in front of me by about 10 yards and were just swinging sticks at whatever they could. A guy directly in front of me, as I was on a sidewalk, and there's a brick wall to our left, I just see this officer come flying at this guy, and it was like watching a hockey game where somebody gets checked into the board. Same thing. He had his baton in both hands, like crossways, and shoved this guy, you know, by his chest into the wall, and was just repeatedly just bashing him into the wall, yelling, you know, get the F out of here, get the F out of here, get the F out of here, you know, and people are just like, we're trying to leave. What are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, and at this point I've got a stick shoving into my back, you know, just like, go on, get out, you know.
Stop resisting when you're not resisting.
Yeah.
But you gotta say like, it.
Like, you told us to go in this direction. We're going in this direction. Like, why are you shooting us? Why are you beating us? What is going on? You know? So yeah, eventually I get to an intersection where it kind of opens up into a little plaza, and the police kind of hold their line there. And yeah, I start seeing paddy wagons, you know, official police paddy wagons and the unmarked vans, like, just driving around trying to snatch people. And at this point, I'm kind of unsure where I am, and I've gotten separated from, you know, some of the people I knew. You know, I'm on my phone, I'm trying to text my friends, like, danger, I'm okay, but I'm looking at Google Maps, like, where am I, where can I go? Eventually, I ended up at Portland State Campus, a few blocks away, and I like, went and just kind of hid in this green space, kind of under some bushes for, like, an hour.
Man.
Until, like, I felt it was safe to come out and, you know, call a taxi to take me back to my hotel.
That's so wild. This is KPTZ 91.9 FM. It's the 2 o'clock hour. I'm just checking in on that. We're talking to Rob Cantley about his experiences in Portland, basically going up against police and federal agents, and the violence that was visited on protesters by the police at these actions. And we're going to have to cut it short pretty soon. So I don't know if you want to, I mean, I feel like we could talk about this for hours, and I want to hear even more stories. Yeah. So maybe we could have you back in a week or two and do some more of
this.
But you know, I mean, I guess if you could just give us your, if you have like a sum up thought on, what you went through there and what you see coming in the future based on what you experienced in Portland.
Yeah. So I guess what I would say is that, the continued violence by police against peaceful protesters is only going to further embolden people to show up in force. It's obvious after 2 months now that people are not going to back down. And no matter how much tear gas is in the world, you know, no matter how many rubber bullets there are, you know, it's not going to stop people from coming out. So, you know, there are specific lists of demands by Black Lives Matter groups and other groups to city councils and other elected departments to, you know, defund the police, reinvest money into community programs, mental health, things of that nature. And people are going to continue to hold them accountable as those demands are not met, or if they're, you know, kind of concessionary little steps that they've taken, which have happened, and protesters come right back and they're like, no, you're not listening to us. This is what we're demanding. And I know in Portland specifically, for their defunding program that was put forward, there were almost 100,000 emails to the city council in support of it. And the word was that was unprecedented level of response from the public. And so I think what we're seeing with middle-class white American involvement, that is extremely significant, because I think for years Black Lives Matter has been shouting about, you know, what's happening in this country and their experiences, but it's the middle class of white America that we really need to get galvanized and on board, because they hold a lot of economic power, electoral power, things like that. So I think we are in the midst of a sea change, and I'm hopeful that the momentum can continue, and that the message of Black Lives Matter and the message of BIPOC people is continuing to be centered and put at the forefront of all of these things. You know, as side issues come up with, you know, federal response and like against Trump and, you know, things like that, but that the message stays on point, that Black Lives Matter, and there are specific reasons why defunding the police needs to continue to be the narrative, no matter how unappetizing people find that term defund. If they can't wrap their heads around it, there's plenty of resource available to find out what exactly that means.
You know, I don't actually like defund the police. I prefer abolish.
I'm right there with
where
you.
I'm going. Hey, Rob, thank you so much for being with us today. And I hope to have you back again soon. This has been really great. And I feel like we'll be talking to you again soon. Thank you for sharing your stories,
really,
and thank you for your
really
service.
I appreciate it, Paul.
Yeah, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. Talk to you soon.